From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. During the Great Irish Potato Famine, more than a million desperate men, women, and children fled Ireland across the Atlantic. Their voyage to the New World was not made easy. Many, many died at sea, poorly treated on what came to be called coffin ships. But there was one tall-masted vessel that made a name for safety, salvation, arriving alive. It was the Jeannie Johnston. It's an incredible tale this hour on Point for St. Patrick's Day, the tale of the Jeannie Johnston. You can join the conversation. Do you know this history? Is it your family's story from Ireland or beyond? With me today from Portland, Maine, is Catherine Miles. She tells the tale in her new book, All Standing, the remarkable story of the Jeannie Johnston, the legendary Irish famine ship. She's professor of environmental writing at Unity College in Unity, Maine. Catherine Miles, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, the numbers, just the numbers. Here we are, we're in the middle of the 19th century. We'll talk about the blight that brought this on, but it sent Irish people fleeing in enormous numbers. You say a million dead in the Great Hunger, and a million more fleeing for North America on ships where the survival rate was what and why?
You know, there were 5,000 of these coffin ships, and most of them were in ill repair. The overwhelming majority of them were timber haulers engaged in a triangle trade very similar to the triangle trade that brought slaves to North America in the previous generation. And when the famine hit, the Irish immigrants solved a problem for these ships, which was an empty leg in the trade. And so ship owners, ship captains, and also ultimately the British government saw in the famine an opportunity to really shore up this triangle trade. But unfortunately, the ships were not at all suited to be carrying passengers. And these were ships carrying hundreds and hundreds of people in deplorable conditions. And that alone, I think, would have prompted really significant mortality rates. But then we started to see waves of these pandemics, influenza, typhus, cholera, and the mortality rates began to go up and up, 30%, 40%, 50%, and as you mentioned earlier, in some cases as high as 70%.
So as if it wasn't bad enough at home in Ireland, where the famine was hitting with a terrible ferocity, explain this trade force that put these ships at availability here. They were taking timber from where to where, and how did what you just describe what emerged as almost a kind of human trafficking because of the desperation of those trying to flee and the way they were treated. But what was the trade? What was being carried before suddenly you had this wave of desperate Irish people climbing aboard?
So this was an era that rings true, I think, with a lot of our contemporary issues. This was an era of peak energy crisis, and instead of peak oil, we were in a peak timber crisis. Timber was being used for everything from fuel to build railroad tracks to build the ships themselves. And these ships were the dominant force in the world. They were the tractor trailers. They were the airplanes. They were the trains. And so this specific and most common triangle trade had these ships arriving in New England and largely what was then called British North America, which we now know as Canada. Mm-hmm. And they would load hundreds and thousands of acres of timber every single year. And most of that timber was destined for the Caribbean, where it was being used in the sugar trade, which was the dominant.
In the sugar trade to make charcoal? Or
that's right.
For what purpose?
To refine the sugar, to build the casks that would carry the rum and molasses.
Okay.
And so these ships, same ships, ultimately would then load up the molasses, the sugar, the rum, take it up to England. And England, while it was already the most powerful empire in the world, was also incredibly resource poor, which is why it had these colonies spread out across the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And so England ultimately had nothing to send back over to North America. These ships are very unstable when they're empty. And so sailors would have to load massive amounts of stone, sand to work as ballast and then unload it once they got to New England.
So instead, suddenly, they had a wave of Irish men, women, and children who, in some cases, were almost treated as ballast. You call it a human rights calamity here, among other things. Take us back to the potato famine. What was going on that produced this in the first place? We're going to come to the Jeannie Johnston, the ship that in all of her trips, her reputation was never lost a passenger. But take us to the famine itself. If we're in Ireland in 1845, You describe quite vividly what people begin noticing and how quickly it rolls in.
So the irony here, of course, is that as far as historians can tell, the potato came from South America, and it was initially introduced in Ireland as a ground cover, but quickly became a very prevalent and in fact, nutritionally efficient food.
I mean, Ireland itself, you point out, had been heavily timbered before that was harvested for the Royal British Navy and more.
Right. I mean, it was this dark, wooded, almost foreboding place during the Renaissance and was cleared for its timber. And then what British officials were hoping was that Ireland would become the official breadbasket for England. And in a lot of ways, it did that. But this is right at the height of the Industrial Revolution. We have large numbers of people in England moving into cities, no longer able to raise their own food. And Ireland can no longer keep up with the needs of Britain. So Britain wants a new system in Ireland. It wants to get rid of the subsistence farmers and create what would be the globe's first industrial agricultural project.
Can we pause on that for just a moment? Because you paint a picture. You call it subsistence farming. But in another sense, it put each Irishman kind of on his own 2 feet, because you could produce a potato crop off quite a small piece of land that never made you rich, but did support your family, fed your family. And the British, the overlords, ended up not liking this because it left no room for the big, as you say, industrial crop.
That's right. And, you know, before the famine, Irish people were taller than their British contemporaries. They lived longer lives. They had dramatically fewer rates of infant mortality. And this potato, which is called the lumper potato, was an almost nutritionally perfect food. It lacked some vitamin D. It obviously lacked protein. But if you could subsidize it with, say, a glass of buttermilk a day, you were really living a fairly healthful life.
So here we are. That's rolling along just fine. And suddenly, not first in Ireland, but here comes a blight. Describe its movement across the world, if you would.
So this is the irony. The blight, which is a sort of fungus, came first from South America. And at the time, people up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States were importing large amounts of seabird guano as fertilizer. And so as far as we can tell, the blight came in this guano and first arrived in places like Philadelphia, Kentucky, Boston, and so on. And we see in 1845 massive potato failures throughout America as well. The blight moved from the states, we think, on these same timber ships that would then eventually carry the passengers, and moved across the Atlantic, took root in both England and Ireland, and then moved across Europe. And so the same year, we see massive potato failures, not only in the United States, not only in Ireland, but also in places like what we now know are contemporary Russia, Poland, Hungary, Sweden, and Switzerland, and so on.
And the terrible impacts. In France, the poor farmers eating cats and dogs. In the Netherlands, you write them making bread out of straw and sawdust when they lost their potato crop.
That's right. And so this was obviously a problem everywhere. It became a catastrophe in Ireland, largely because the British government had a very different response to it than, say, the French government.
How so?
So this was the era of laissez-faire government. So the Prime Minister Peel, who was serving at the time when the famine first hit, he had attempted some sort of loose social programs. He was importing grain from the United States. He had some soup kitchens. But this was an incredibly unpopular decision. And so when he was replaced, and when in fact the British government created a colonial famine response team, this response team sort of looked at the political climate of the era and said, you know, we're going to let colonies do their own things now. And so we're really going to let this be a localized system. And if local communities want to try to save their own, that's okay. But we're really going to wash our hands of it.
And meaning if they starve, they starve?
If they starve, they starve. And this was this notion of divine providence, that really, you know, God would intercede if God wanted to. And if God didn't, well, then probably we need fewer Irish people on the planet.
I mean, there was such a tone here. You quote the editor of the London Times writing, "The Irish peasant starves because his whole subsistence depends on the produce of his own patch of ground. And in that failing, he has nothing to offer in exchange for the necessities of life elsewhere." It's kind of tone there of, so tough luck, buddy.
There was incredible racism at this time. There was the belief that the Irish people had not evolved to the extent that other white people had. And you see these very derogatory depictions of Irish people as simians or ape-like with their knuckles dragging on the ground. And there was this caricature known as Paddy, who was this half-ape, half-man, who filled newspapers both in England and in the States at this time.
They were smart enough to know very quickly that many of them would have to leave to survive, and they started looking for ships, those timber ships first of all. Among the ships on the west coast of Ireland, the Jeannie Johnston, how many trips did it make across the Atlantic carrying those fleeing refugees in a way?
11.
And the death toll in all those trips?
Zero.
It's an amazing story. We will come back and look at that flight from Ireland and the story of this one tall-masted ship, the Jeannie Johnston. Catherine Miles is with us. Her new book is All Standing, The Remarkable Story of the Jeannie Johnston, the Legendary Irish Famine Ship. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the legendary tall-masted ship, the Jeannie Johnston, that brought thousands of Irish from famine to America. Catherine Miles is my guest, author of the new book, All Standing, The Remarkable Story of the Jeannie Johnston, the Legendary Irish Famine Ship. Catherine Miles joins me from Portland, Maine. It's quite a story she tells of the whole situation surrounding this, which became very grim indeed, and then at sea, grim as well. Death tolls, death rates of as high as 70% on the so-called coffin ships that brought a million Irish to North America, but not on the Jeannie Johnston. Catherine, we've got a response from our listeners here on Facebook. Rhiannon O'Donovan says, my family came here at the height of the Great Hunger, Black 47, 1847, I guess. I am Irish and will never forget. Another listener, though, Catherine, John Shannon writes, Tom, it wasn't a famine, but a failure of just one crop. Famine or just the Great Hunger, or is there a difference, Catherine?
Well, you know, famine is ultimately a political term, and a famine, I think, is a moment when people are not able to eat and are dying of starvation. So it's true that it was a failure of just one crop, but this was also the failure of the overwhelming food source for millions of people. And I think what made this such a human rights atrocity is, while it is true that other crops were growing in Ireland, they continued to be exported out of Ireland throughout the famine. So they were being sent by force over to England to feed the English people while the Irish people were starving.
Let's go to Robert in Woodford County, Kentucky. Robert, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. That was the exact point that I was just about to make, what she was referring to, the siphoning off of all the natural resources of the Irish into the British Empire. As you were saying, they stripped their timber. Likely they were taking their cattle and all the other foods that they had been dependent on for years and thrived and prospered on. As she was talking about, their stature was higher, taller.
Until it all came apart in this great hunger, famine. Call it what you will, it was bad enough that it sent a million out and plus out of the country and a million dying in Ireland. Catherine, I want to begin to look more closely at how this takes us to the ship, and I wonder if you might tell us the story through a couple of historic figures or figures out of history that you follow in this time. One, Daniel Riley, one, Nicholas Donovan, two different roles at that time. Introduce us to them, if you would, on our way down to the Jeannie Johnston, Catherine.
Sure. So these are two men who occupied the same space and time, which is Tralee, which is in County Kerry, the southwest of Ireland. And Daniel Riley is a small farmer. He's somewhat more successful than the straight subsistence farmers in Ireland, which is to say that he's of what they called the second class. The first class, the lowest class, were cottiers. And these were people who were living in really nothing short of hovels. Daniel Riley, on the other hand, was able to sell a little bit of grain and a little bit of produce to export out. And so by no means a man of means, but at the same time, he was a man who had a little bit of liquid capital, which he could use.
So what did he see when the blight came to his farm?
So he saw, first of all, rapidly increasing grain prices, which, you know, ironically ended up being very beneficial for him. But he also saw very quickly the misery that was happening around him and the attempt of landlords to use the famine as an opportunity to evict their tenants, which is largely what happened. And in some cases, landlords were not only evicting their tenants but forcing them onto these famine ships and, in some cases, paying their fare. So I think he saw the writing on the wall in some really important cases and knew he had a young wife, a brand new wife. He had a brand new young son. And I think he really saw that their future depended upon their ability to flee this worsening situation.
How did the blight actually hit the fields? What would the experience be of an Irish farmer at that time, like Daniel Riley, when the blight arrived? How did it travel and how did it show up?
This is an incredibly pernicious little fungus, and it travels through water. And so what happens is the spores can spread basically from water droplet to water droplet. And once it's taken hold of a plant, it's an incredibly rapid and very dramatic assault, basically. And there are these really compelling stories of people who lived through the blight who would say they went to bed one night and everything was fine, and they woke up the next morning to this incredibly dark, rotting stench, and that was how they knew the blight had arrived. And within hours or even a day, entire fields of potatoes would go from really very healthy green leaves to this rotting, black, putrid slime.
People became desperate to try to survive as that potato crop went away. You described them making black porridge, bleeding their own livestock for the blood. It's sort of in the way we think of as, I mean, Maasai tribesmen do this in Kenya, but for the blood to then thicken and make porridge of until finally they'd have to slaughter the breedstock itself.
And then try to do even worse. There's a very sort of grim moment in the book where a woman is brought to trial because she's stewed the family dog. And we see these terrible stories of cannibalism and, like you mentioned, bleeding livestock, attempting to eat nettles and other basically inedible things, and people dying on the roadside because they had basically made themselves toxic and poisoned themselves in this last-ditch effort to eat.
Man traps around farms to keep one Irishman from another, trying to keep raiders out of their gardens and farms.
Right, and we should say these raiders were out for, you know, discarded heads of cauliflower. So this was not, you know, this tremendous moment of robbery and stealth. It was people who thought, well, maybe if I could just grab a few clippings from
anything
these different vegetables. Right.
And man traps, like what? What does that mean?
So they would dig these enormous pits that were 6, 8, 10 feet deep, and they would sort of cover them with a little bit of foliage, and they'd put spikes and water in them. So if people attempted to steal out overnight to try to find these scraps of food, they'd fall into these traps and be found by the constable the next morning and brought up on charges and sent either to prisons or workhouses.
So here's Daniel Riley. He sees his crop fail. He's in the southwest in County Kerry. You describe him as understanding pretty early on that he and his family could very well be up against an impossible situation, that is, impossible to survive if he didn't think radically.
He did, and he had several family members who had preceded him on these ships, and so he also knew what was on the other side. So he had to make a really quick decision. And, you know, the fares for these ships were, for Daniel Riley, they would be several years' salary, basically, that he would have to save up to get his family across. So he had to be very strategic, too, about figuring out how and when to get out.
Introduce us to another man, then, his contemporary there in southwestern Ireland. We're talking 1845 or so, Nicholas Donovan.
Nicholas Donovan is a Catholic merchant. He's an importer and exporter, and he's the first generation of Catholics in Ireland that are fully franchised. And what this means is that for the first time, Irish people who are Catholic can own land, can vote, can hold office. And so he's a new generation. He had witnessed his father and his grandfather, who were also both importer-exporters, he had witnessed the limitations that had been imposed upon them by the British government that really sort of hemmed them in terms of their political and economic success.
And Catholics had been specifically prohibited from doing this kind of business before his generation?
Yes, there were these things called penal laws, which ultimately worked to disenfranchise the Catholics. The idea that the British government had was that so long as they were swearing allegiance to the Pope, they couldn't be trusted as British citizens.
And so you would have had a Protestant sort of a mercantile class in that era before 1832 or so.
Right. We see this significant striation that starts to happen between people of the same class but of different religion in Ireland, where we see this significant sort of haves and have-nots based on whether or not you are allowed to vote, you are able to own land, you're able to do things like serve on grand juries. These are all important things in terms of making a place for yourself culturally and socially.
So how did Nicholas Dunham, here's a man of means, a trader, and along comes the famine. What means were under his control that he began to think through?
So as an importer and exporter, he was someone who knew very well the sea and the ways in which the ships really defined not only traffic and commerce, but ultimately politics as well. He had never owned a ship. He had always leased ships where he would – and he would bring in lead, cask irons, he would bring in timber and these sorts of things. And when the famine hit, he saw an opportunity in this. He saw that people were paying – in some cases, significant sums of money to sail mostly over to North America. And he also saw that the more successful a ship was and the better that the ship's reputation was, the more people could charge and the more publicity that they got for this. And so he saw in this an opportunity to advance his own career by way of helping other people. So his motives are not entirely pure here. And at times he really comes across as an opportunist and something of a schemer.
But he would own the Jeannie Johnston. Let's go to our callers, Randy in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Randy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Is there a distinction here between Ireland and Northern Ireland in this potato famine discussion? And if there is, the books I've researched dealing with Northern Ireland deals with a Scotch-Irish community there, the Scotch being moved in by the British, mm-hmm. the Irish being forced out.
Mm-hmm.
And Scotch-Irish people head for the colonies, mainly because of taxation, the Protestant Catholic turmoils there, mm-hmm. and various political situations going on. And I really haven't heard much about potato famine in that northern region.
Randy, let us pick it up. Catherine, is there a geographic distinction when it came to the Great Hunger? Ireland, Northern Ireland, you name it.
Yes, and we should say at this time, politically, there is no distinction. So all of Ireland is a British colony mm-hmm. at this point. But what we do see is very different economic systems happening within these two places. Northern Ireland has largely become industrialized at this point, and so it's working on things like flax, and it has factories. And so potatoes are serving there, but we don't see quite the numbers of agricultural people there that we do in the South. And so there are mortality rates. They are significant. There's a great deal of immigration happening from there. But it's not quite to the extent of the crisis that we see, for instance, in the South and the West.
So here's Daniel Riley with his family wanting out, and many, many others as well. A million and more would go across the Atlantic. Here's Nicholas Donovan, the importer and exporter, Irish, Catholic. How does the ship come into this picture, the Jeannie Johnston? What's its origin?
So the Jeannie Johnston was built by a really interesting man by the name of John Munn, and he was a Scottish immigrant. His father had come over in the previous generation, and his father had created a shipyard that John Munn inherited and quickly made it the second most prolific and successful shipyard in North America. And he was this very interesting, very duty-bound, philanthropic individual. He never married. He lived this very monastic life. And when the famine hit, he saw in this a real sense of duty and obligation in terms of helping the Irish. He led Canada in terms of donations made to Irish refugees. And he saw in creating the Jeannie Johnston an opportunity not only to employ new Irish immigrants, some of whom, in fact, most of whom, had never worked on a ship. And so he was willing to trade them first. And then with the launching of the Jeannie Johnston, I suspect, though I can't prove, that he knew all along that this was going to be a famine ship. He took these really interesting liberties when he built the ship. It's very much a standard bark, which is a square-rigged ship. It's a very flat-bottomed, kind of fat ship. And he took these liberties doing things such as making a little bit more space below deck so that a grown man could walk around. Mm. It's shaped slightly different below deck. And I think that he knew that there was an incredibly good chance that this was the industry the Jeannie Johnston was destined for.
So where exactly was it built, the ship?
So it was built in a tiny little suburb of Quebec called St. Roch, which is where most of the British shipping was centered at that time. And this is where, you know, the timber would come down out of the Ottawa River Valley. It's where the world was getting most of its timber. And Quebec was very much the sort of central command post for the British government in North America.
What were its main dimensions? How long? What kind of capacity to carry passengers?
So legally, it was allowed to carry 200 passengers, and that was a restriction put on the ship based on its size by the U.S. government. And this was an incredibly crowded situation. A family of four would be given 6 feet square of a bunk, and they would have to lay head to foot. And these bunks would be stacked three tall. So, you know, even with this regulation, which was considered humane, there was absolutely no space to move about or really communicate. We see some depictions of this in movies, and we see people dancing around and, you know, having mass and all these things. Right. But that was really not the reality on most of these ships.
When did the Jeannie Johnston then take on her first manifest of refugees fleeing the Great Hunger?
So spring of 1848, this is the start of the second shipping season. Black 1847 has just occurred, where we see all these massive mortality rates, and the entire world is terrified at this point. People are talking about this strange phenomenon called ship's fever, which strikes without warning and kills people. And people are looking very distrustfully at Irish immigrants. And so it's a real challenge already for Nicholas Donovan to have this ship, knowing that it's about to ply this trade that's already become infamous and notorious across the world.
You know, we're accustomed to, let's say, immigrants coming up from Mexico and sometimes being treated very badly by the coyote who bring them across deserts and so on. We know the stories of death tolls there. In this case, were these high death tolls on the so-called coffin ships because the ship's captains were careless or cruel or exploitive? Or was it, you know, were these was this disease-based in a way they couldn't help?
It's both. There were very few mandates placed on these ships by the government. The one mandate that they did have was that people were allowed a pound of either cornmeal or oatmeal, and this would be their daily food ration.
1 pound.
Mm-hmm. 1 pound, which is not enough to keep a well person mm-hmm. alive, let alone someone who's already been compromised by famine. They were also required to give them about half a gallon of water, which this water would be not only for cooking and for drinking, but also for bathing and washing clothes and things like that. At the same time, these convict ships, which are taking sort of the worst hardened criminals to Australia, these convict ships had more regulations. They were required to carry doctors. They were required to give the convicts meat every other day. And one of the things that the Irish representatives in Parliament kept saying is, you know, are you really saying that these suffering Irish are no better than murderers? And the answer by and large was, yes, we are.
Mm. Well, the new book is All Standing, The Remarkable Story of the Jeannie Johnston, the Legendary Irish Famine Ship. Catherine Miles is with us. Listeners, you can join us. Is this your family's story? Do you know the ship? They may have come on from Ireland. Who made it? Who didn't? Can you see why a ship without a death toll would have seemed such a miracle? And non-Irish, is there an echo of this story in your own family's American journey? Here's the Pogues with Thousands Are Sailing, the story of a famine-era journey from Ireland aboard a coffin ship.
It was not to be on a coffin ship. I came here and I never even got so far that they could change.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the legendary tall-masted ship, the Jeannie Johnston, that brought thousands of Irish from the Great Hunger to America. Catherine Miles is with us. Her new book is All Standing, The Remarkable Story of the Jeannie Johnston, the Legendary Irish Famine Ship. There's an excerpt at our website. Check it out, onpointradio.org. And you can join us. Did your family make this voyage from Ireland fleeing famine? Do you know the ship they came on? Who made it? Who didn't? And Irish Americans on St. Patrick's Day coming up this weekend. Is this bittersweet memory there alongside the parties and parades? Is it always there? We're talking about, Jennifer writes us, Catherine says, don't forget about the brand new Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. Beautiful new facility if you're in that area and want to see something of it. We've got lots of callers. Don in Mattapoisett, Massachusetts. Don, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Catherine Miles.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to mention the fact that the Jeannie Johnson still lives because there was a replica ship built and it sailed to North America in 2003, and I was fortunate enough to be on board when it left for the return voyage from Newfoundland to Kerry.
Wow.
And so the Jeannie's very close to my heart.
Can you picture it full of those fleeing the hunger and what that must have looked like, Don? You've actually been on the replica.
Well, we were modern. We had all the modern appliances, hot showers, so it was a little bit more difficult to picture people living in darkness and squalor. However, the point I'd like to make about the famine was that for the majority of people fleeing, they were actually subsidized by the landowners. At that point in time, vast tracts of Ireland were owned by absentee landlords, you know, the British nobility, et cetera, and they were actually taxed based upon their tenants, because the Irish were tenant farmers at will. They didn't own any of the land. So when the crops failed and these people became a burden on the landlords, it was expedient for them to actually just put them on a ship. So they handed over the £5 or whatever the passage money cost, which obviously the starving Irish were unable to afford themselves. And so that was a reason some of these people were able to get on these ships. And of course, many of them had never even seen the ocean before. I mean, people didn't travel very far from their place of birth in that time. And so for them to get on a ship and go on the ocean, particularly a hazardous voyage, I mean, I can't emphasize enough how difficult it is to sail the North Atlantic, especially in the winter, and particularly on the passage west, because you're facing the prevailing winds. So, I mean, there's just no modern equivalent of the enormity of this challenge facing these people, not to mention the fact that they were totally malnourished and in poor health prior to getting on board. So, you know, the fact that the Jeannie Johnson was able to maintain the lives of its passengers was simply a tribute to the fact that they had good hygiene, a doctor on board, and they showed some compassion for human beings.
Great points all done, and I'm really glad you make them. Thank you so much for your call. Catherine Miles, give us a sense of that voyage when people finally got on the boat, and maybe their way paid by their landlords, as Don points out, for their own advantage and reasons. But you describe, I think it was the first voyage of the Jeannie Johnson, right out into sort of Titanic iceberg lanes on their way west.
That's right. Everything Don said is absolutely correct and very important. And, you know, on a good trip, this would be a 45-day voyage. The ship captains had to sort of plan their trips around the icing of the North American ports. The idea here was to try to get as many people as possible to Canada. That's what the British government wanted. They thought that they could participate in the timber trade there. The British government was hopeful that Irish people might settle in Canada and ultimately create another breadbasket for Ireland. And so there was a great deal of incentive to try to get these ships into Canada. And they actually offered much cheaper passages to get there. Most of the immigrants, of course, ended up coming down from Canada and trying to get into the United States. But these ships were, by and large, trying to get to Canada. And, you know, because it was icing up, they were really limited to, say, May into about October or November that they could get there. And so they would depart largely in April. Like I said, on a good trip, it would be 45 days. It could easily become 60 days. Ships would founder left and right in storms, in icebergs. They would simply split apart because they weren't well made. And so the idea of making it to North America safely was very much a question for those on board.
Have you compared the crowding and conditions on these ships to what we would have seen on ships coming out of Africa in the slave trade then and earlier? I mean, these were not people in chains. I don't want to compare them in terms of saying they were the same, and not at all. But at the same time, just in terms of the numbers packed on board, the survival rates, have you done any comparisons, Catherine?
I have. And as you say, obviously, I don't think anyone would ever want to undermine the significance of the African slave ships. And certainly they are one of the greatest atrocities in human history. But what I really want to suggest here is that these Irish famine ships are too. And one of the major differences was the captains aboard slave ships were often paid based on the number of living slaves that stepped off their ships in North America.
Yeah.
The captains aboard these Irish famine ships were paid when people stepped on board the ships. And so if you were an unscrupulous captain, you had absolutely no incentive whatsoever to keep these people alive. And in some cases, some of these ships were carrying 700, 800 people, and the captains would just sort of shut them in down below and not open the holds again until the ships arrived in New York, Boston, Quebec. And they'd find these mortality rates of, 70%. They'd find dead people lying with the living. They'd find just enormous amounts of human waste and suffering. And I think that's a story that's an important part of our history and one that we need to keep in mind when we talk about immigration, both large and small.
On a 45-day or more trip, we're talking a living hell there. Aled in Toronto. Aled, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I'm not Irish, Tom. I'm Welsh.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Welsh are the Celtic cousins of the Irish. I want to point out that when Sir Walter Raleigh, back in the days of Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth I, introduced the potato into Ireland, and it came from originally the potato from Central and South America.
Mm-hmm.
They were asking for trouble because the climate of Central South America is so different from that of Ireland, which is quite damp. And so they were really asking for trouble in that case. The second point I want to make is that not all of Ireland was owned by absent landlords. Many of the Irish landlords were in fact, actually Irish. Now, at that time, if you read the history, there was quite a to-do in the British House of Commons over what was happening in Ireland. Of course, it was a Conservative government at that time, and they didn't care two hoots. But the Whigs, or the Liberals as they came to be, were very concerned about what was happening. So it's not a black and white situation. This is a very interesting story, aspects of which I had never come across before, and I'm certainly going to read the book. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Yes, Aled, I'm glad for your call. I mean, you report to us, Catherine, that the Prime Minister Peel had at one point secretly arranged to import cornmeal from America for Ireland, I guess, but that cost him his career. There was real debate about what should or would be done.
This was an incredibly unpopular political move that he made. And I
Amazing.
Think that for many of the British people at the time, they felt like they had already been subsidizing Ireland in so many ways. And they were asking a question that I think we ask right now, which is, to what degree should we be socially responsible for one another? Should we be taxed to help other people? And that's a question that at the time, British government was not willing to answer in the affirmative as far as Ireland was concerned.
Anything at state expense, there was real opposition to. You described Quakers who came into Ireland and did heroic work keeping Irish families alive.
That's right. They were, and there were big movements throughout the United States of people who were Irish and not Irish, trying to help. And they were sending over grain. The U.S. was commandeering some of our naval ships and trying to get food into the country as well. And as you say, the Quakers were really, really heroic in their attempts to work selflessly for years and years. And they eventually reached this place of such compassion fatigue, where they realized that even their best efforts were such small efforts for the largeness of this atrocity that they kind of just sort of raised their hands and said, we can't do this anymore. We can't help anymore. And they were defeated.
Let's go to Jim in Boston. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
My ancestor came from Ireland in 1845.
Mm.
I know it from church records here in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
What I was wondering is, where do you get the manifest for the different ships?
A good question. Catherine, how do you track that down, or can you?
There are a couple of different ways you can do that. There's a really wonderful online resource called Ships Lists, and it has a lot of the ships' manifests from these Irish famine ships. You can search based on year, based on someone's name, or based on the ship itself. The U.S. government has kept very good records of this as well, and so if you're able to make the trip to the National Archives in Washington, D.C., you can find nearly all of the surviving records as well. These ship captains were required to file paperwork both at their port where they were departing and then also at the port where they were arriving and to file with those customs offices. So, in fact, there are really pretty good records both at the National Archives of England and also the States.
Jim, good luck with that. My own family tracked it down sometime back, 1682, out of Ireland. We don't know what the circumstances were, but it's trackable. Richard in Duke Center, Pennsylvania. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Very well. What do you know?
I've got a book here of some of the ships, the names of the ships that were used in 1847.
Let's hear it.
Okay. The Larch, the Queen, the Avon, and the Virginius.
And those were 1847 out of Ireland headed for the
yes.
States. Do you know if they were passenger ships or cargo?
They were passenger ships.
Richard, I appreciate your call. Catherine, is there a list of infamy alongside the charmed history of the Jeannie Johnston, the names of the ships that with the worst death tolls?
There is. There's a really great book by Edward Laxton that came out probably almost 20 years ago now. And there are some historical inaccuracies here and there, but he does provide a really great list of these ships, as well as some wonderful stories about some of our most famous immigrants. The Ford family came over on one of these ships. He talks about the Kennedys coming over. And I think that that's an important thing to keep in mind, too, is the legacy is both good and bad. And what I want to say is, while this is an Irish story, it's also very much an American story, because I think by and large, whether or not our ancestors came over on an Irish famine ship, the overwhelming majority of our ancestors did come over on a ship. And so it's a real moment of shared history for all of us.
How did the Jeannie Johnston, give us more insight into how on all these trips, all these sailings, they kept their passengers alive? What was different?
So as Don mentioned earlier, the Jeannie Johnston did carry a doctor, which was very unusual, and his name was Richard Blennerhassett. I think he's one of the most both fascinating and tragic figures in the book. And He was born to an aristocratic family, and he was a very well-educated doctor. He could have had his choice of positions after he graduated from medical school in Edinburgh, but he chose to serve the underrepresented, and his first job was aboard what was called a coolie ship, and these were ships that took indentured servants from India over to South America. And on his very first voyage, there was a massive cholera outbreak. People were dying by the dozens, and he single-handedly was forced to treat both the living and then also to dispose of the dead. And at that point, he vowed to do everything he could for the rest of his life to ensure that this never happened again on these ships.
That's so a good doctor to have on your side.
He's a wonderful doctor to have on your side. And he bucked current trends in contagious disease prevention and treatment at the time. And he was one of the few people who understood that things like fresh water, air, moving about, cleaning laundry and linen were really important to stemming contagion, and that people needed to be quarantined right away if they showed any sign of illness. So I think he's the real hero of this book.
What about the Jeannie Johnston's reputation at the time? How widely known did it become as a safe ship to travel on? And what did that mean for it?
It very quickly became known as what they called a charmed ship. And there was the miraculous birth of a baby boy named Nicholas Riley Easter Sunday morning, the day before it set out on
its
first
passage. This is Daniel Riley's son, who we spoke of earlier.
Yeah, so his wife, Margaret Riley, was 9 months pregnant when she stepped aboard the ship. And I think, again, that's also a real testament to how serious they were about needing to get out. They understood the profound risks, both to mother and child, by stepping aboard in this condition. And she went into labor shortly after midnight, and with the help of the captain, the doctor, and the crew, delivered this healthy baby boy who survived and flourished. And he's become a real emblem, both in Ireland and America, kind of a folk hero of sort of perseverance and strength and the idea of sort of locating your own version of the American dream despite these incredible odds.
Give us the full name of that child who, in fact, they named after the owner, doctor, and entire crew of the ship, the Jeannie Johnston. Do you have it there?
It's a very long name.
Let's
so I'm
hear
actually
it.
I'm going to have to actually turn to this page in the book so I can get it right. So his full name is Nicholas Richard James Thomas William John Gabriel Carls Michael John Alexander Treberet Archibald Cornelius Hugh Arthur Edward Johnston Riley. So named for the captain and crew of the Jeannie Johnston.
Unbelievable. Just amazing. And Nicholas Donovan, the owner, did he put this charmed reputation to profitable purpose?
He did, and he saw very clearly that this was a great opportunity to become a media darling in Ireland, which he very quickly became. And so he was very strategic about publishing letters that Attridge would send from, Baltimore, New York, Quebec, once he landed and everyone was safe. He was really good at using the media to his advantage and also enhancing the reputation of the Jeannie Johnston. And by the end, people were traveling deliberately to sail aboard this ship because they knew that it was their best chance at survival.
St. Patrick's Day this weekend on Sunday. With stories like this behind us, we understand the full kind of texture of the Irish story. There's much to celebrate in resilience here. There's always much to remember about human suffering in these stories, Catherine. You tell both in this book, and it's really terrific. We're grateful to you for telling the story so wonderfully and for being with us today. The new book is All Standing, the remarkable story of the Jeannie Johnston, the legendary Irish famine ship. Catherine Miles is the author. Catherine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
To all. We'll go out with the Dropkick Murphys, Heroes from Our Past. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And by virtue of their fortitude and singleness.